When you think of the key figures of the Revolutionary War, maybe you think of Paul Revere or Sam Adams. What about John Singleton Copley? He was a painter whose portraits of Revere, Adams, and others are considered iconic images of the Revolution. But Copley also painted British generals, and he considered himself British. He even left New England in 1774, never to return. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock has his story.
John Singleton Copley was an only child, the son of Irish immigrants, born on July 3, 1738. As a young boy on Boston's waterfront, he heard the shouts of sailors and hawkers and watched prostitutes trudging home from the taverns.
He grew up facing the sea, and so did Boston, right? So that the ocean is really the circuit board of his world, and the capital of his world is London.
That's Harvard historian Jane Kamensky. She's the author of the new book, A Revolution in Color, The World of John Singleton Copley. Copley's widowed mother ran a tobacco shop on the waterfront. She later remarried a man who was a painter and engraver, and Copley started drawing before he was a teenager. There are Copley paintings in museums in New York, Chicago, and many other cities, but the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston owns the largest collection of his work in the world. That's where I met author Jane Kamensky, right in front of Paul Revere, painted by Copley in 1768.
We don't know why Revere commissioned the portrait. It was an outlandishly expensive thing for an artisan to do, but there's something about the directness of the image, the fact that Revere stares right at you with his chin in his hand, and I think there's almost a tendency to confuse the painter with the sitter, as if Copley himself was like this American who exemplified a nation. Almost everything about that is wrong. There's no nation in 1768, not even the hottest of the American liberty men, as Revere would have called himself at that point, foresee an independent United States. Copley is very much on the fence about the unfolding revolutionary crisis and would prefer to paint men in velvet and women in silks when he portrays himself just a year later, when Copley portrays himself just a year later in a wonderful pastel portrait. He doesn't look like somebody who would sit down at the table with Revere, and indeed he wasn't.
What does the American Revolution look like through Copley's eyes, and how does that affect his painting, or how do you see that in his painting?
So I think the first thing we need to remember about the Revolution in Copley's eyes is that he only sees it facing forward, where we see it facing backwards, right? So when he paints John Hancock, who's hanging in the other gallery, and John Hancock is sitting by a ledger in 1765, Hancock is not practicing the signature he's going to put on the Declaration of Independence. You know, so Copley's Revolution is a forking road that has peaks of intensity in 1765 with the Stamp Act riots, and then goes quiet again. Peaks again in 1768, around the time that Revere is painted. Boston is occupied for its temerity. But then, even after that, goes quiet again. Flares with the Boston Massacre, the affray on King Street, which Copley's brother tries to rush into production as an engraving that our good friend Paul Revere steals. But then, even after the massacre, goes quiet again. So I think one of the things we have to understand about Copley's Revolution, and really everyone in the gallery that we call Revolutionary Boston, as if they are all sitting and waiting for it, is that it stutters. Copley is very proud of saying his whole life that he leaves before the war was foreseeable, which, like many things Copley says, is both true and not true. He leaves the colonies in 1774. By that point, a Rubicon really has been crossed in the form of the dumping of the tea in Boston Harbor. He wound up having married his politics. In 1769, he married Susanna Farnham Clark, Suki, who was the daughter of one of the wealthiest Indies merchants in Boston. This was a very good thing until it wasn't. And among the things that Copley's father-in-law sold was tea. One of his best customers right up until the tea party was John Adams. So among the chests of tea that are dumped over into the harbor on December 16, 1773. The largest single consignment belongs to Copley's father-in-law. And at that point, the family really does become persona non grata. He's really pushed out of Boston after the Tea Party and leaves in the spring of 1774. But it's not a revolution when he leaves. It's a rebellion. And one of the sort of reorienting things about viewing the events of 1775 through 1783 from where Copley sits in London is that we see the revolution offshore as Britain's American War. So Copley is relatively fixed during the revolution. He just wants the status quo ante, which of course is impossible.
How does he become, after death, so closely associated with the Revolutionary War? I mean, when does that start to happen?
It doesn't really start to happen in a significant way until the American centennial. And people are thinking about the roots of this now 100-year-old experiment. The portraits begin to come out of houses. So the MFA is founded in 1876. It opens on July 3rd. And by then, Copley's children have all passed. Some of the paintings are filtering into public collections. So it's really in the period known as the colonial revival that that work that was intended for private viewing and private consumption becomes part of a national patrimony. I think you would have found this in some ways ironic. The whole museology of the modern era would be ironic, right? These things hanging separately and in ways that suggest veneration, things that he wouldn't have thought of as going together, and our inability to see, or sometimes even our disdain for, the vast history paintings that he considered the summum bonum of his career. So it's a backward lens that turns his sitters into revolutionaries and puts them together to create a kind of patriot pantheon. And I think a place that you see that is right to the side of Revere, where we get Samuel Adams, John Hancock, who of course had enduring enmity with each other, Dr. Joseph Warren and Mercy Otis Warren. And they hang there as if they are the super friends of the American Revolution, when in fact at the time that Copley's painting them, really only Samuel Adams is being painted with his hot politics as a strand of the self-presentation he wants. Hancock is being painted as a merchant, Warren as a doctor and not as the martyr he would become, Mercy Otis Warren as a gracious woman in blue silk and not as the future historian of the American Revolution. So it's happenstance that turns them into a set of stamps almost. And I think that would have seemed startling.
And it's in hindsight, too, that we just see those people and what they represent is this American thing today.
Right. I mean, they would have, by the 1760s, have called themselves Americans. But what they would have meant by that is more like what we mean when we call ourselves New Englanders. It was a region of Britain. It had more cohesion by the time those revolutionary super friends were painted than it had at the time of Copley's birth. So there was some sense that there had been alliances, tenuous, sometimes faltering, sometimes thickening political alliances among parts of what became the group of the 13. But they certainly didn't mean Americans as something you would see on a passport, right? They were imperial citizens of Britain in this second-tier seaport.